listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 272 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, where in this episode we'll be discussing the state of streaming and where we're at now. A lot has changed, and there's potentially a lot of change on the horizon. There's some news, there's some data that we're going to discuss, some interesting things for you to consider as you promote your music and build fan bases. My name is Kevin Bruner, and joining me is Chris Robley. Chris, how are you?
I'm good. In the never-ending week-to-week saga of my album is almost finished mode, my album is almost finished. I'm talking with a publicist, putting a plan together. I think tomorrow I'm going to shoot a music video. So things are moving. I'm almost finished.
I think I could be in that. I'm not quite as almost finished as you, but I was promised that I would hear the final two songs that I haven't heard mixes for today. We'll see. I've heard that.
We'll see. Yeah, likely story.
All right. Well, it's been an interesting start to 2021 already. It's sort of feeling like a repeat of 2020 so far. There's some interesting news and things happening that have implications about the future of streaming and just an update on streaming in general. We haven't really talked about just the idea of where we are with, the streaming landscape in a while. We've talked about like Spotify or have mentioned some announcements by Amazon and such, but we've got some data and interesting things to discuss today. Plus, we have calls and emails later on. So, yeah, Chris, should we get into it? Or do you have any more comments?
No, let's get into it.
All right. So there's a couple items. And first off, I should say, if you want to get paid for your music on streaming platforms and other platforms that pop up, whether it be social video platforms, downloads, physical, still want to sell CDs or vinyl, you should go to CD Baby, cdbaby.com, sign up, distribute your music. It's the place where artists get paid.
Accurately and on time. You don't just get paid. You get paid on time and accurately. Imagine that.
Yes, on time. Which, if you look at Twitter, other people don't do that.
and I mean, while we're just, talking about payments, that also means weekly.
Yes. Assuming you hit the threshold you set in your account, we will pay you weekly, which is a big, nice feature because a lot of places pay quarterly or some even every 6 months. And that's no good. You don't want that. CDBaby.com, where you want to go to get paid. And that plays into some of the stuff we're going to be talking about today. I'll go ahead and lead out with that. Chris, in the last couple episodes of the podcast, I think we've teased some data that we were going to make public, and we have done that. And the biggest piece is that in 2020, the money that we paid out to artists increased by 26%. Increased 26%. During a pandemic.
All right. I'm glad you said it. During a year in which, we dealt with something we'd never dealt with before, or, not in 100 years. And music engagement was very healthy. Do you want to say what the figure is?
Yeah, I was going to say the figure. In 2019, we paid $100,953,195. In 2020, we paid $126,782,389. That's a lot of money.
Almost $127 million.
Yeah, almost $127 million. And that's a 26% increase over the previous year, which is massive. And all that is money to independent artists. It's not the, the couple indie projects by major label artists that they parked here. This is all independent artists getting paid. That's a lot of money. That is a lot of cash.
Yeah, I mean, it's how do I say this? I think there's a sense that over the past 5 years, there's been a kind of like whittling away at the musical middle class, or you know, a sort of a viable independent music path. And a lot of times I see the opposite. I see that there are more ways to make money than ever as an artist, more ways to reach an audience, some free, some monetized, but you know, no matter how you're building an audience, there's monetization potential. So I just think that this is one sign that the independent sector of the music industry is extremely healthy. Tons of people are not just making money, but making livings. And the kind of doomsday narrative is certainly incomplete, if not wrong.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about this number to me is the increase is amazing. And of course, we like to see that. But when I talk about it being over the course of a pandemic, it's not just that, oh, there was a pandemic in the world. It's that the pandemic directly impacted the music sector a lot. People can't tour. That was a huge problem. But the thing that was most interesting to me when I saw this number is that people aren't commuting to work, which is where most people listen to music. And so I'm curious to see how 2021 pans out as people start, you know, going back into the office. I know now more people are going to the office than were in most of 2020. Still, a lot of people aren't. We're not. And, you know, people are starting to open things up. And as the year goes on, hopefully some normalcy will start to prevail by the end of the year. But I know that for me, there was times where I wasn't listening to a lot of music because I wasn't commuting to work. And that's when I usually listen to music. I know a lot of people do at their desk during the day while they're working. For me, that's something it's really hard for me to do because I'm always in meetings and stuff. And it's like, I'll sit there with headphones on for 3 hours and realize I didn't turn the music on ever because I was constantly jumping in and out of meetings and turning things off, getting interrupted and all that kind of stuff. But so anyway, that's one thing that really struck me, knowing that user behavior shifted greatly in 2020 and revenue was still up considerably. And, you know, this is points to a lot of the work we're doing behind the scenes to make sure you get paid. This is where our interests with you, the artist, are aligned, because there's a lot of work we do to make sure we're getting paid accurately, on time, and that, you know, our catalog is fully monetized. So it's not just the top 1,000 tracks. We make sure they take our whole catalog as an opportunity for all our artists to get paid, because we get paid too. So, anyway.
Yeah. Well, and actually on that point, if anyone needs a clarification, the figures we quoted were actually the payout. So when you say we get paid too, actually more was kind of generated, but we didn't include our cut in that figure.
Yeah. And this is what got paid to artists. And if you go to the DIY Musician blog, you'll see the infographic that Chris and I are looking at, because what we're going to talk about coming up in a minute plays into some of the news that also landed this week. But this payout figure, first off, some news that landed this week was someone's projection that, you know, the indie sector is eating up the major label share. And they projected by 2030 that indies start overtaking the major label market as far as earnings and the makeup of, you know, earnings in the marketplace. And so that's an exciting thing. And I think that whatever you think about streaming, as far as what it pays out, because we're going to talk about that as well. There's some news related to that. Whatever you think about that, you have to admit that the streaming platforms themselves have done far more for pushing independent artist music to more listeners than the CD world ever did, or the download world ever did. So that's one thing that you have to be in agreement on.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I was talking about this on a panel last night, how any streaming platform, there's a certain segment of artists who are just angry about kind of the economics of it. But I was in defense of those platforms, saying there was no record store equivalent where if you bought a James Taylor CD, the person at the desk was sort of operationally inclined to then say like, oh, you might also like this Loudon Wainwright CD. You know, it's like the algorithms, the recommendation engines, all that stuff is really amazing in that way and completely different from the CD world, like you said. And then add to it the fact that they all, or many of the big ones, give you the opportunity to kind of brand your storefront, do things on those platforms. Like you couldn't walk into a record store and switch out like the poster up near your CDs or advertise a show next to your CDs or any of that stuff. It's really, I think artists take it for granted that they can get into their dashboards on these platforms and stuff, but it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. So there's a lot of positive movement that has happened for independent artists in this area. Let's move on to, well, maybe we should talk about the SoundCloud news here. This might be a good point because we're also going to discuss the breakdown, the percentage breakdown, where that revenue is coming from by service, because I think it's something that for most, this is the most surprising piece. But SoundCloud this week announced that they're doing what they're calling fan-powered royalties. And it's something that's been discussed in music circles for a long time. The way streaming rates are figured up, it's not a simple thing of like, oh, someone pushed play on my music, I got X amount of money. There's so much more to it than that. In fact, I think SoundCloud here has, they said, under the old model, money from your dedicated fans goes into a giant pool that's paid out to artists based on their share of total streams. That model mostly benefits megastars. That statement is true. The first sentence, the model mostly benefit megastars. Yes, and that's where territories come into play and such. It's not just like one giant pool. There's pools for different territories and regions, and it's all figured up differently. So what SoundCloud is doing, under fan-powered royalties, you get paid based on your fans' actual listening habits. The more of their time your dedicated fans listen to your music, the more you get paid. This model benefits independent artists. So they're launching this in April, which is just around the corner, but it's only for people that are in a certain tier of their service. It's a small group of people. And they showed I wouldn't really call them case studies because they don't really give the information about these artists, but there was like an artist, they said, had 120 some thousand followers before. They were getting $100 a month. Now they're going to get $600 a month under this new model. And then they showed another artist that had like 12,000 followers. This is all on SoundCloud now, all SoundCloud. 12,000 followers on SoundCloud, and their earnings would go up over 200%, which makes me think that they used percentage because the number wasn't that interesting looking. Because if the one person that had 120,000 followers went from $100 to $600, the person with 12,000 followers probably went from $10 to
to 50
to
bucks,
22, yeah. And that was the 200. So it's an interesting idea, and like I said, it's not anything that's new to the discussion. This is only impacting SoundCloud, and it'll be sort of a good test case, a sort of a lab study on this royalty method.
I'm laughing to myself, sorry, because listeners are probably like, wow, Chris is really bad at math. I had just forgotten that you'd said 200%. I couldn't remember the percentage figure, which is why I went from $10 to $50. It was magical thinking.
You're doing artist math.
Yeah, right.
So anyway, it's going to be interesting to see. And there's, we're talking about sort of the state of streaming and whatnot, and artists are getting paid. And this is an attempt of SoundCloud to try a different model. Part of me, Chris, this is my skeptical side. Part of me thinks that SoundCloud is just doing this to try and keep their site relevant, in that, you know, they require artists to direct their fans there in order for their site to succeed. And so now, right, they're all their documentation around it says, make sure you tell your fans to listen on SoundCloud. But that's where I have a problem with this, is that there are certain artists and genres that have huge following on SoundCloud, and it's been really helpful in the EDM market and with hip hop. A lot of hip hop artists have really built followings on SoundCloud. I would say for your average rock band, not so much. At least that's not what I've seen or experienced. And, you know, I haven't seen any singer-songwriters really building a following on SoundCloud, because to me, most of those people won't qualify for the Premiere program. And so all that effort is trying to get fans to adopt a platform they don't use already in a lot of cases.
Well, so, you know, and this might be unfair of me to say, because I don't know what SoundCloud's sort of near-term plans are for wider rollout or wider eligibility amongst artists. But I've noticed there is, on platforms like that, a kind of exclusivity to their, you know, their top-level monetization, or that, and that always just rubs me the wrong way. I mean, I know companies only have so much bandwidth when they extend promotional services and handholding and stuff. But when it comes to just the basic mechanics and fairness of how their business runs, how things generate money, I kind of feel like it's BS if it isn't available to everyone, or at least everyone who is eligible for their platform. So that would just be my one complaint. Do you know if they have a wide rollout planned?
I don't. I would assume that they don't at this point. I'm sure this is sort of like, let's see what happens. I could be wrong. But the problem with SoundCloud is it's like Bandcamp. When you start paying out royalties, you got to make sure the people own the content. And I can go to SoundCloud right now and upload any artist music I want, and it'll be there, even if I don't own the rights to any of it. I think they have some fingerprinting technology that may stop some of that. But I know that part of the reason for having this separate section, you know, premium section for artists that, you know, meet certain thresholds, is to have more controls around some of the content that gets uploaded to make sure that the rights are cleared. Because that's a big problem for SoundCloud. And, you know, people have said, why doesn't Bandcamp create a streaming service? And they kind of have, but at the same time, Bandcamp also, that's a problem for their platform as well. There's a lot of unlicensed content that's on the platform just from artists uploading stuff like cover songs that aren't cleared, you know, those kind of things, or royalties aren't being paid on. So anyway, I'm curious to see how this SoundCloud thing goes. Now, the idea of fan-powered royalties is interesting, but why I'm curious is because I could see it also having some problems as well. And for if it wasn't clear how it would work, ideally the idea of fan-powered royalties is that I pay $9, you know, $10 a month to Spotify for my subscription. If I listen to only you, Chris, all month long,
I don't get that $10.
You don't get that $10. And the idea being, well, if Chris is all I listen to, he should get that money. And it sounds simple. It seems like an accounting nightmare. It sounds simple in that term, but what if I listen to you, I have my $10 subscription, and I listen to one track of yours and nothing else the entire month. But then the next month, I listen to, I'm just in a Chris Robley groove, and I listen to 10,000 of your tracks, like on repeat the whole month, and that's all I listen to, and there's $9 or $10. But then you see the scenario can go, okay, now I'm in a Chris Robley groove and five others artists, and I'm listening to all of them a lot. It almost incentivizes you to get your fans to listen to you once and to nothing else. Because it's like, now I listen to you a lot, I listen to someone else a lot, and all these other artists, or maybe I listen to you a lot, and then three other artists, I listen to their track once, or all of them. It's like, it starts to become this weird, like, unpredictable. If ultimately you're trying to get down to the idea of, like, when someone pushes play on my track, I should be compensated fairly for it, I can see just as many problems with the fan powered royalties system when you start really thinking about it.
I love the like super aggressively territorial marketing tactic of the future where artists are saying to their fans, please only listen to my song once.
and nothing else.
Literally nothing else ever. Please just like limit the amount you listen to me, but only listen to me. That makes some really weird marketing.
Please. The best way you can help me out is to listen to less of my music and nobody else. At that point, just buy a dang download. That's the right. same. So anyway, that's interesting. I think it'll be, you know, I know a lot of the industry will be looking at SoundCloud. Honestly, I think the DSPs really don't care what happens here. There's so much like the way streaming payouts happen is so oversimplified. Even what I mentioned about there being different pools for different territories, and in some of those territories there is dominance of majors, and others there aren't. Like in Latin America, some of the indies are just some of the biggest artists around, because those markets, it hasn't been such a major label dominant force since the beginning of the recording industry. So a lot of independent artists are huge in other regions. And so even just looking at pools for different regions, I downloaded, if you search, there's a guide that somebody put out there about how royalty payouts really work. And it's somebody that some of you will recognize. I'm gonna say who it is. You can go Google it. And it was like a 40-page PDF with all these charts, graphs, math, and I lost interest after page three or whatever. I'm like, this isn't what I get paid to do at CD Baby. I can't crunch spreadsheets. So it's mind-numbing though how the it all works together. But there's a lot of things that you probably didn't think about, because the whole fan-powered royalties idea is of extreme oversimplification of the idea that someone just pushed play and they only listened to you for a month, so you should get their money. Well, was it on a phone? Was it a free account? Was it a paid account? Was it a bundled account? Was it in India? Was it in Brazil? Was it in the US? It's all those things. It's like, oh, I didn't think about how everything's different depending on certain factors. And so anyway, it'll be interesting to see. But would love to hear people's feedback or comments about it. And if you're an artist that's going to benefit from this, if you are in that SoundCloud program, we would love to hear from you as that rolls out and how it impacts your revenue. And if you're willing to share data, we'd love to take a peek and let artists know about it. And, you know, from CD Baby, we're like, we want artists to get paid more. So if this is something that is a viable solution that should be advocated for on other platforms, absolutely. We want to know about it and be a part of it. So, yeah. And you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com, or you can call our listener line at 360-524-2209 and let us, know how that goes. But, let's move into talking about the breakdown of what we're seeing. And the breakdown isn't, that sounds like we're falling apart. The pie chart that we posted. The slices of pie. Because this data is fascinating, because I know the majority of artists would be shocked when they see the pie of streaming revenue.
Yeah.
And by pie, we mean by what services have, what the size of slices from each service.
Yeah. So we should ask everyone to do a thought experiment before we tell you the answers and say, which platform do you think did the most, and by what percentage of the overall digital distribution streaming earnings do you think it was?
Yeah. And I think we could also like extend that thought experiment a little earlier. If you were to rank the main ones in your mind, wherever you are, this is all summed up for artist payouts worldwide, by the way. So if you were to rank the main digital streaming services in order, by percentage, what would it be and what percentage would you assign to them? Because this is what's fascinating to me and how it's changed over the years. So now that you've got that number in your head, we're going to tell you. So coming in at number one is Spotify, which probably isn't a surprise, but I bet the surprise is the percentage, 40%. And why I find this fascinating is because I bet 90 to 95% of the conversation about digital platforms and streaming services and focus is on Spotify.
That's what I was going to, I mean, 40%, you know, they're the number one spot. 40% is huge for revenue, of course. But like you say, I bet for a lot of artists, Spotify is the 100% focus of their streaming related promotion efforts.
And for you as an artist, oh, go ahead.
Oh, I mean, to some degree, I get why that happens, not just because they're sort of the talk of the industry in a lot of ways, but they do give you some great tools, you know, like we were saying earlier. So it feels like a very actionable platform in that way. But I mean, I think we say this probably every episode of this podcast now, but it really should not, it'd be irresponsible to make it the sole focus of your promotion. And it's kind of insulting to your fans who are clearly all over the place in terms of the platforms they prefer.
Yeah. So 40% Spotify. Now, reminder, this is the aggregate of our catalog. So your fan base may be different and shift, but it's important, I think, to understand because this represents more of the fan community and not, and a lot of times, and similar to what we were talking about with the SoundCloud thing, SoundCloud, that requires you to go out and make your fans adopt a different streaming platform than they may be wanting to use. It's not a dominant streaming platform. It has a big fan base, but it's not as big as these we're talking about here. And so 40% Spotify. Number two, this may not be a surprise, at 18.5% Apple Music. And also, I should add that these percentages are based on the artist's earnings, not usage. So,
right, and you know, clearly, Apple Music is a separate thing.
Yeah,
I was just gonna say Apple Music is a separate thing from iTunes, but there was significant iTunes revenue still in 2020. Maybe you know, less significant clearly than it was 3 or 4 years ago, but it's iTunes accounted for more than 7%. So if you combine Apple Music and iTunes, Apple had a huge chunk of this pie.
Yeah. When you combine them, it's still like 25%. So Apple Music, number two, number three, this is probably going to be the shocker for everybody. YouTube Music at 8%. It doubled in 2020 from 2019. It
went from crazy
4% of the revenue share being paid to artists to 8%. That's a lot.
And
huge.
And then
increase.
Anyone who listened to our previous episode where Kevin and I discussed YouTube for about 14 hours, we talked a lot about Content ID and sort of ad revenue that's generated by sonic fingerprints of your music on YouTube. That's not what we're talking about here. This 8% is YouTube Music, you know, the subscription streaming side of
not
things.
Not Content ID.
That's separate revenue that isn't in this pie chart.
Yeah, if that was in this pie chart, it would skew it. But what we were trying to show is streaming platforms that where the revenue is coming from. Because again, most artists would think, oh, I need to put all my eggs in the Spotify basket and then not pay attention to these others. And that is just not what is happening. YouTube Music doubled. So that means that if you're not paying attention to what's going on there, you might be missing something. The next one, just right behind YouTube, is Amazon at 7%. So Amazon is doing some really great things. If you don't have the Amazon for Artists connection, go to your CD Baby dashboard and get it. There's some great stuff in there. Why I love Amazon.
Actually, sorry, I think that one is not initiated in the dashboard, is it? I think that one you go directly to the Amazon.
Oh yeah, that's right. You go to app, the
and then you yes. choose your distributor. There'll be a little CD Baby icon you press Correct. For a quick verification.
Correct. I think we do have information in the dashboard about it, but that might just send you to the app. I'm not sure, but yes, you are correct. And the thing I love about Amazon is, and why it's growing is I know that they're putting a lot of effort to it and just really started diving in on the streaming service a couple of years ago. But voice is really something interesting that's driving a lot of traffic there, people with their Alexa devices and how that's changing user patterns and growing market share for Amazon. So very interesting to see. I can run through the other ones quickly. Pandora was at 6.7%. Let's see. Then there was Sound Exchange at 1.9%, which is got lumped in here. Google, which is a holdover. We still had Google payouts at 1.79% because it was at the end of 2020 where they, I think it was in the fall where they officially closed Google Music.
Google, yeah, it was a Google Play, got sort of folded into YouTube Music.
Deezer at 1.3%. And I know in some territories where some of you are listening, Deezer is one of the top services. So it has relevance. Rhapsody, Rhapsody's still a thing? Rhapsody's still a thing. I think it gets bundled in with certain, maybe Microsoft products. I'm not sure. Tidal at 0.4%, and then other was at 1.6%. So other is like, you know, you've seen us announce a lot of services from all over the world, and that's where they all get lumped in. But the interesting thing is, you know, if you go to the DIY Musician blog, you'll see this. We have 2011, 2017, and 2020. And the main thing why we were showing that was like, it's insane. 2011, iTunes, 77%. Amazon was 10.5%. But that chart wasn't just digital platforms. That was, you know, like cdbaby.com. Amazon there was probably mostly physical.
I think also 2011 was the year Spotify came to the US, right? It's because Spotify accounts for 2% of the revenue.
Yeah.
2011.
Yeah. And so you can see how things have shifted, but ultimately the big takeaway, and one of the reasons why I wanted this data out there for artists, is that it's a fractured, you know, it's a fractured fan base out there that are listening on so many different platforms, and you must approach the market accordingly and understand where your fans are listening. That's why tools that we have like Here Now that are smart links are so critical to your music promotion, because you cannot assume that all your fans are on one platform, and you cannot assume that all your opportunity is on Spotify. There's lots of amazing editorial opportunities on Amazon, Apple Music, and YouTube Music. Yes, Spotify has given some tools that give a little bit more accessibility to artists, and the ability to push things through yourself. And I'm hoping other platforms follow suit, and I believe they will. But it's just one of those things where it's like, especially if you're not in the United States, and, you know, like I said, some territories, Deezer is, like in Latin America, some territories, that's one of the top streaming platforms, and it's huge in France. That's where they're from. So you really have to be aware of what your fans are listening to and understand that just posting one link is not going to do it anymore. And it's a challenge. You know, that's why that whole SoundCloud royalty thing, I think it's great as an experiment, but even if I had it and it was unlocked, it would be like, well, I'm not going to be a salesperson to my fans to go use a particular platform. They're not going to do it. It's getting more and more fractured.
Right.
I've got to address them where they're listening to music, and it's going to be a wide variety of places.
Yeah. And then I don't know if we're sort of wrapping up this segment, but we have been focusing you know, this entire discussion on the chunk of money being generated by streaming platforms, and, you know, in the case of iTunes, download. But this is probably obvious, but it's a good reminder that this is just one slice of your overall music revenue picture. And ultimately, if you're an independent artist, you kind of have to think of yourself as a bit of a cottage industry. And until you get to a certain point, it's a lot of one-to-one, you know, artist to fan, relationship building, and that you're, you know, potentially selling vinyl to your fans, selling t-shirts to your fans, you know, pre and post pandemic, there's gigs or there's even ticketed live streams. And then there's a whole bunch of other more passive income like YouTube content ID and, you know, Facebook, Instagram monetization and stuff like that. But it's a whole big picture. Streaming's not the only thing. It's not necessarily even the most important or lucrative thing if you have a kind of a 360 view on your career and your fan community. So don't get, I guess what I'm saying is don't get bummed if you didn't get rich off of streaming this year.
Yeah, that's one very important thing to note, because like you, we already mentioned, YouTube content ID is not represented here in these pie charts. If we did, it would skew it totally differently. The 126 million that we paid out includes YouTube content ID, includes Facebook and Instagram usage of your music. It includes sync licensing. It includes physical
publishing revenue.
Publishing revenue. So there's a lot of things that make it up. The point of like focusing on the platforms is that we know that, like I said, artists are talking about Spotify probably 90 to 95% of the time and focused on that. And the data is showing that that's not your 95% of your revenue is not coming from that. And to contrast that, back in 2011, where 75% of the revenue was coming from iTunes, it pretty much was a world where you could drop an iTunes link and a link to buy a CD and you had most of your fans covered.
Those were simple times, weren't they? I mean, they probably didn't. They didn't feel like it in the moment, I guess. But now I look back, I'm like, oh yeah, iTunes had a good long run of being really like the only important digital music platform. So it was CD sales, like you said, buy my CD and buy from iTunes, and that was it.
Yeah, I hope we're not looking back at the good old days during the pandemic.
No, I wasn't looking back with rose-colored glasses. Just they were simpler times, but maybe not not better, just simpler.
Correct. Yeah. Anyway, so check that out. You can check out that information on the DIY Musician blog. It's important that you understand the landscape of the musical landscape and how it shifted. And and understand that where things are going with streaming and what services are important, and understand where your revenue is coming from. And with that, we have...
Oh, sorry. I just thought of one other little bit of advice, which is I think that it's important, anyone who subscribes to Spotify and, you know, who uses Spotify for artists knows kind of what that experience is like, both from the artist perspective and the listener perspective. I think it's important to do that same thing for all of these big platforms and to actually test out using them. Figure out how they serve up new music recommendations, figure out how people, if at all, can talk to one another, or, you know, just dive in. And I don't mean you have to constantly be paying four different services, subscription fees, but a lot of them have free trials and whatnot. So, you know, do some research and actually use them so you know kind of what you need to do on the artist side of things.
Correct. Agreed. All right. Well, if you have thoughts about where the state of streaming is, or if you're somebody, again, that's doing something with other services, like if you've done something with Apple Music or Amazon, or you're finding some path to success on some of these other platforms that don't get talked about as much, we'd love to hear about it. You can call our listener line at 360-524-2209, or you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. And with that, let's get to a call. We've got two calls about Spotify. As I said, everyone talks about Spotify, but these are good questions. And they're quick. We've got some emails as well. So I'm going to hit the first call right now.
Hi, guys. My name's Carla, and I'm a musician, of course, and I've been enjoying your podcast very much. Very helpful and just a great resource. I have a question, another Spotify question. I know you get a lot of those. If my music, one of my songs, is released on a compilation CD and put on Spotify, can I submit it to the editorial playlists? That's my question. I mean, it'll still be under my name, but it won't be my album. Okay, thanks a lot. You guys are doing an awesome job.
Thanks for the call, Carla. The quick answer is yes, you can, but there's a little asterisk there. Like, I'm assuming that you are the one that's distributing this compilation album. So you're the one signing up and sending it out for distribution. So you can only select one track from an album to be the one that gets featured. So that would have to be the track. I just point that out because if it is like you're working with a collective of people and there was one track that was identified as like, this is the key track for the compilation that we're promoting, you can only select one track. The other thing is you can only promote a track once. So if it's on an album later, you wouldn't be able to promote it again through that tool. So those are just things to consider. But the short answer is yes. But depending on how you're going to use it and where, there might be some considerations if you want to do it now or wait till it's on your own album, because they'll let you do it once. Anything to add there, Chris?
No, nothing at all.
Good, good. We answered it. All right, I'm going to go to an email. Good morning. I just listened to the YouTube podcast and wanted to give my two cents on digital that works. I'm in a band. Judd Who's is what it says. I think that's the band name. Judd and then H-O-O-S. And I also run the digital portion of a media agency that also specializes in events. 2020 was a hard one for us. Yes, it was. No conferences, no events. Facebook events are key to getting interactions. I like to schedule posts inside of my Facebook events, reminding people about the show and just informing interested people with music and videos. As always, it's a great idea to post Facebook videos, not YouTube, so they can watch the videos within Facebook without leaving the site app and reducing digital friction. I am a fan of running Facebook IG ads that target custom audiences, specifically people who have showed interest or going in past Facebook events or people who have watched 25% of your music videos. These are super engaged audiences that need to be re-engaged. What I've learned over the years is concert goers go to concerts and your fans will interact with your content. Getting people outside of your circle is so much more difficult. You're better off making sure everyone of your fans in the area shows up or interacts with music content than trying to reach a whole new audience, especially when you're running ads. Keep up the good work, Chris.
I have an amendment to that approach.
Okay,
so
go ahead.
I see the wisdom of what they're saying in that, you know, you've got this gold mine of your own existing fans and you don't want to let them, you know, go cold or fall out of love with you. So you spend time creating content that keeps reaching them because you've got them in these custom audiences. And that is totally great. But I also think you could always have a component out there in the ad world that is reaching targeted, but, you know, reaching strangers based on their interests or sounds like artists or whatever. And you don't have to spend much at it. It's more of like a maintenance thing that could possibly always be adding a few people at a time to that existing audience, which now is suddenly part of your existing audience who also receives the content you're creating to keep that audience engaged, if that makes sense. Because otherwise, like inevitably, no matter what you do, you're going to have people fall out of your fan base. They, for whatever reason, you might start making music that speaks to them less. They might have kids and have no time to listen to music, whatever reason. And so if you only concentrate on keeping your existing fans happy, you're going to, it's like a, what do they call it? A war of attrition in a way. So I think it's healthy to constantly be building it at the same time.
Yeah, I think the one thing though, yes, I agree. The one thing I'd focus in here on what he's saying that I think is interesting is that really using the Facebook events page and that there's power in that that isn't just regular Facebook that probably goes underutilized. I know I underutilize it at times, And, you know, that's when you create your own event on Facebook. And then people that say, oh, I'm going to go, there's more options as far as just creating content specifically for that group that reengages them, that gets pushed to them, reminds them of the show, but it's not just about the show. And it's almost like building a little more dedicated community, especially in a particular area, if it's, you know, a concert that's in real life.
I have an admission, and it's that I underutilize Facebook events and Facebook groups because I'm lazy. And the it seems so, like, if I were to go live on Facebook and then you got to do the thing to make sure the video goes to the event stream and then you post it to your group and then on your personal feed, I'm like, oh my God, no, too much. I'm like nervous enough just pressing go live. So it's pure laziness that I underutilize those things.
Well, I've had some issues with like using StreamYard because you can create the event in there. And I've had some issues where the way they have you say it, because you can do it for Facebook and YouTube at the same time, works for one platform over the other. And when you edit it on the platform, it messes it up. Like, it messes up the event. And so I tried using events for that very purpose of like, hey, we're going to do this, you know, talk through our discussion about our live album. And I created in StreamYard, created an event on Facebook, and then I went to optimize it better, and it messed everything up. It like broke the connection to StreamYard. And so there's some challenges there at times. But anyway, good advice. Let's move on. Here's another one. Hi, Kevin and Chris. I've been with CD Baby for about 4 years now, but I just discovered the podcast and I've been going through the catalog. Keep up the great work, and I look forward to hearing more from you. My question is sparked by your episode and discussion on sync licensing and ensuring that the metadata on each song is filled out properly when submitting it for distribution. Specifically, I'm curious about the similar artist or sounds like category. In short, how do you know what other artists your music sounds like? What tips do you have to get close in order to categorize your music correctly for others to discover? I have close confidants that I share unreleased music with to help me understand my sound. However, results can be all over the map. Thanks again. Take care. John B. I have some thoughts and comments on this. One, it is challenging to get your friend's opinion. Sometimes it can be good, but I always put that in the, that's just a data point. That's like, okay, that's an interesting data point. This is one thing where tools like Pandora, if you're in the United States, or Pandora, I think, is available in a couple other territories, you can use a service like that that's going to build like radio. You could do it in Spotify. It obviously wouldn't be your unreleased music, but you can go to Spotify Radio and start a station based on one of your songs and then see what other artists it pulls into that it's thinking are similar.
Actually did that the other, so it wasn't on Spotify. I think it was Pandora. I can't remember what service it was. I'm pretty sure it was Pandora, but I was on like a page in the analytics where you can see other artists that have been played a lot along with your music in stations and stuff like that. And I actually was so interested in it because I didn't know the artists, but I thought it might be useful for this exact thing of maybe, you know, targeting or listing sounds like artists for CD Baby or sync purposes. Anyway, so I took a screenshot of it, but that is a good advice thing. There's another thing you can do. There's a site called everynoise.com. And if you go there, you can type your artist name in and potentially find sort of the genre that you fall under. And then you can click that genre to find some other artists in that realm who are, you know, getting, I think how it works is based on their streaming activity, their name gets bigger. What do you call that when it's a word?
Word bubble.
Yeah. It's not exactly that, but yeah, I'm pretty sure like the more streams they have, the bigger their name is. But anyways, check out that everynoise.com.
Yeah. I would, when they say sounds like, here's what I tend to think about. I think about similar demographics. So, for small town poets, my band, there's a difference between direct sound, like where someone listens to it and go, oh, that sounds exactly like this band. Honestly don't know what that would be, but but what I think about it is, who are bands that would be great for us to go on tour together? Or who are bands that when I see their audience, I feel like our audience, as far as the demographic, is similar. And when I do that, I think of, okay, for Small Town Poets, Death Cab for Cutie, The Shins, and bands like that, where I'm like, okay, I feel like our demographics are very similar. And somebody who had that go, oh, this band sounds like Death Cab for Cutie, even though we don't sound like a Death Cab for Cutie ripoff, they would probably make the connection of why we said that. So that's how I tend to look at it. It doesn't have to be so exact. It's just to get people in the ballpark, especially as it relates to sync licensing. If somebody's like, I need a band like Death Cab for Cutie or The Shins, but I can't afford that track, they would probably feel like if they heard some of our tracks, it was in the right ballpark. It may not be the right thing that they're looking for, but it wouldn't feel like, you know, they're looking for a kind of a poppy alternative rock band and they're getting a hip hop track. That's, you know, it would be in the right ballpark. So don't overthink it, but just try and understand where relational information might help. All right. Let's go to the call and we'll finish with the email. Here's another call.
Hey guys, this is Josh from the band Crash Cadet. Love the show. Thank you for doing it. I had a question about Spotify. I've noticed erratic listenings. I'm just wondering why it happens. Sometimes one day I'll see a song of mine gets 100 plays or 200 plays, and then the next day it'll get 3. Do you know why that occurs? Thanks again. Love the show.
I wonder if those are days in which you're popping up on a algorithmic playlist like Discover Weekly or something like that, and maybe it's coinciding with that. I mean, Friday would be Release Radar, Discover Weekly is Monday, right? And you know, there are other algorithmic playlists you could pop up on as well, and then a lot of times that playlist listening is very passive, so it's gonna spike on the day you're there and then dwindle again.
Yeah, that was my first take. And yes, I have seen that happen in my own account, Josh. You are not alone. My takeaway has been something similar to what Chris just mentioned. So when you release a track, you know, if you use the Spotify pitching tool, it will push it to all your followers' release radar. So you'll see a bump. That won't be like a one-day spike like what you saw. But it's typically like a little bit later, a couple weeks, maybe a month, where you might start seeing what Josh described, like this random spike. Oh, 100 plays and it's gone. My estimation is those things are like Discover Weekly, or it could even be a New Music Friday playlist. A lot of those playlists like Discover Weekly, I think people will listen to once, like the day it's updated, hear if they like anything, and they might go follow up with that artist, or they just move on. It's not like, at least that's how I've used Discover Weekly. It's updated. Oh, it updated today. I listened through it. All those artists got a stream from me. Many of them never will again. So it all spikes on that one day. So that would be my assumption. And there's some other playlists that are happening algorithmically. Like there's a daily playlist.
Daily Mix, is that what it's called?
Yeah, Daily Mix or something that it's called. It's a similar thing. Then there's like your top tracks. So there's a lot of little algorithmic playlists that are happening where it could be that one of your tracks got pushed into multiple users all at once and it sees a spike and then goes away.
Yeah, I notice I get like a handful of streams every once in a while from those like Rewind, I forget what it's called. You know, they're basically like a little bit of nostalgia. Here's what you were listening to last month or last year or whatever. Yeah. Sometimes those sort of just randomly pop up on my Spotify for Artists.
Yeah, it is weird. And it can be somewhat maddening. Like you see this spike, you're like, oh, something really cool is happening. And then the next day, back to 3. Oh, no, it didn't. So, yeah, that's probably what's happening without any more information. And, you know, definitely if I know Josh probably isn't doing this, I'm assuming not because he probably would have said, but when you buy fake streams, you'll see that kind of activity as well. But that's not saying that these streams that he saw are fake. It's probably those Discover weeklies and things like that. Anyway, I should also point out that Carla and Josh both had exceptional calls. They said their name. They gave a quick shout out, got to their question, and it was very nice.
It's fun. Yeah, and we hold our listeners to a very high standard of being succinct, and then you and I just ramble for 2 hours.
That's right.
You have 2 minutes, listener, but we get 2 hours.
Somebody sent an email. It literally was like this tiny font and looked like a whole chapter of a book with at least 30 questions in there. And I'll get to that one eventually, not necessarily on the podcast, but it was so many different questions and things. I'm like, I can't even make it through this.
It's like its own episode.
Yes. All right. We've got one more email. Kevin and Chris, a question and a comment. I'd like to advertise my music for sync licensing placements, but I don't want to be involved with the negotiating and pricing. Is it beneficial at all if I were to advertise my music for sync licensing and direct people that are interested to CD Baby licensing page, or is this something I should not be doing? Also, the Pandora webinar on Zoom was fantastic and really helpful. I understand the AMP platform so much better now, and the hosts were super fun. Looking forward to more webinars in the future. Thanks, William.
I think so. I don't know if you have an answer. My quick answer would be, if you're going to spend to advertise your music to someone, spend as if you're reaching someone who could be a fan, rather than trying to spend to reach music supervisors or, you know, whoever you think is in the sync world, because, you know, eventually you might make a fan who is a music supervisor, and they're at that point, they're going to like your song and perhaps it fits one of their needs, and they'll come find whoever, you know, you've got on board to manage your sync rights. And if that's CD Baby, great. Then they can negotiate it with us and your problem is solved. But I would spend the money to reach fans.
Yeah, I agree. The one thing I would say as far as sync placements, it's not a bad idea on your official artist website to have a page or a section where you're saying, hey, want to use my tracks in film or TV? Here's information on how to do that. I think that's the best thing to do as it comes to like making it known, like, oh, especially if you've had some placements, because then it really ties it together. And if somebody does stumble across it and it, I'm like, oh, their music's been used in TV and film, maybe I'll check out what they have. I have a need too. So, you know, there's opportunity there. But yeah, as far as advertising it, that's not really that audience. There's so many parameters around a sync placement that are out of the control of the music supervisor and as it relates to their own personal taste. Meaning, if I'm working on a show and say my favorite type of music is what you do, Chris, if it was, I'm really into the singer-songwriter or the kind of music that you're doing, Chris, but then I'm music supervising a high energy movie with lots of chase scenes and action, and the
Fast and the Furious 18.
The Fast and the Furious, yeah. And the production says, we want industrial rock. That's what the director is saying. We want this kind of vibe for it. It doesn't matter that the singer-songwriter might be my number one genre, my favorite type of music to listen to. The production requires something different. And so I have to go find music like that. So really, music supervisors tend to just have a large collection of music that they like. They usually have very broad tastes. So they know when they, you know, it's not like they're like, oh, this sucks. I'm on a action film that wants industrial music. I don't even know what industrial music is. Usually music supervisors are very, very well versed in all genres. And so some, you know, approach might be if there's a music music supervisor that's working on a show that does a lot of music in your genre, is you might find them on Twitter and just say, hey, love the music you're picking out for the show. If you're ever looking for indie artists in a same vein. I'd love you to check out this my music. Here's a link. They may never get back to you. No harm done. But they might. I know that music supervisors, most of them really do like using independent artists because they really do like helping artists and exposing audiences to new music. It's just there's so much relying on what the production wants, and that's really out of their control to some extent when it comes to music. So they get to pick the music, but it's not like they get to decide everything about it. So, and it also depends on the music supervisor. They have more power than others. Some that have been around for a while get to just run the whole show as far as what the music is and all that. Someone that's on a different production and newer to the scene might not get as much say and are really more of like a music coordinator. That's probably more than they wanted to know. So anyway,
it's good reminders.
And William mentioned the Pandora webinar. We have been doing a CD Baby Insider series, and you should be checking these out. We've had Facebook and Instagram. We've had Spotify. We did a Spotify one this week. We did the Pandora one, and we've been having them come through in rotation. We've done YouTube, and a lot of them have been just direct Q&A. It's your opportunity to get direct answers from people that work on and at these platforms. So you should check those out. If you're not on our email list, you should be. But if you're on our email list, we've been emailing you about it, and you should have all the information. But more are on the way, and they're really cool.
Yeah, I've been really encouraged by the fact that these representatives from the platforms truly want to hear from you. It helps them do their job better. Helps them shape how artists use their platforms and how, you know, like, so the most recent one, I attended the Instagram, Facebook one, and they tried their best to answer every question that was asked. They were super receptive to getting back to people that they didn't have time to answer because we ran, you know, the hour was up, but definitely get involved with those.
In fact, I said the Spotify one happened this week. It actually happens March 9th, which may be after the time of when people hear this, but that's when it's supposed to happen. Yeah. And, you know, going back to what we were talking about with the breakout of different streaming revenue and where it's coming from, the nice thing about one platform not ruling everything is that there is more appetite to hear from the artist community and what is going to serve their purposes than ever before. I can tell you, 5 years ago, that was not the case. And in my interactions with all of these DSPs, they're really wanting to understand better how artists want to use these platforms, the tools they can develop to make it easier for them to reach fans on platform. Because I think what Spotify has shown that when you make those tools, because they were the first platform to really make those tools and really help define streaming in a new way, artists will talk about it. And so they'll send their fans there too. And so these platforms are like, hey, we want market share. We got to get artists excited about it. So there's a lot of appetite to hear from the artist community. So check those out. It's a really good opportunity to make your voice heard. And we should say one last time that if you have a call or if you want to call us, you can call our listener line at 360-524-2209, or you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. And we did a call out for social. If you're having social success or some of these new tools that are popping up on all these platforms, I want to hear about it because we haven't talked about the state of social in a while, Chris. And every time I open up a platform, it seems like they're trying to be a different platform.
Yeah, we should do that episode and we could dive into Clubhouse as well.
Yeah, like Twitter's launching stories and the ability to charge for exclusive tweets. Yeah, that's going to happen. Instagram has all these features that are like other platforms. Facebook is trying to copy TikTok. All these things, it's like it's gotten very confusing. And where it used to be like, Twitter is for this, Instagram is for this, Facebook is for this, and then there might be Snapchat or TikTok. They're all starting to look the same.
Yeah, you know, I do have to hand it to Twitter, though, because their copy of Instagram stories, which I suppose is a copy of Snapchat, They call them fleets, which I assume is like a fleeting tweet because it goes away, which I don't know. I know it's cute, but I think it's brilliant.
That's funny. That's funny. So yeah, I would love to hear from artists, and we'll be working on that episode because I think a good social rundown, like where do I even put my attention these days? And, you know, it seems like after Twitter banned Trump, a lot of people were like, oh, I was just here for crazy Trump tweets. So. that actually got me looking at Twitter more again, like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that was said today. This is just like watching a, I don't know what it's like, but and he's gone now, so it's like, what do we need Twitter for? But we will talk through all that stuff. So, all right, Chris, I think that's going to do it for this episode.
Okay.
All right.
Until next time.
Until next time. We'll catch you later. See ya.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.